Welcome to Cornell's East Asia Conversations, a podcast that captures the latest thinking on issues of contemporary and historical East Asia. We share stories, experiences, and research grounded in multidisciplinary approaches to East Asian and international studies. This podcast is produced by the Cornell East Asia Program in Urus Hall Room 140 here on the Cornell campus.
In graduate school, I did an ethnography of construction workers, right? So I started in the cities. I started in Beijing by sort of, I had a research partner named Qi Xin, who was at the Tsinghua Department of Sociology at the time. Her and I would kind of talk our way into these construction sites. Mainly she talked her way into these construction sites. She would bring gifts to the bosses who ran these construction sites. They're always subcontractors. The bosses are never local people. They're rural people who are subcontractors, right? They never talked to each other, these people. They're there to work, and then they're constantly sending money. They go to they use a postal savings bank to send money back to their family. Sometimes the whole team will be unexpectedly let go if production slows down, or they'll bring in another team from another province. So it's highly precarious, unstructured, it's highly precarious work.
We are very pleased to have Julia Chuang with us here as a visitor. She is an assistant professor of sociology, now teaching at Boston College, and is here to give a talk in our Contemporary China Initiative lecture series. She received her PhD in 2014 from the Department of Sociology at UC Berkeley, and then immediately followed that with a two-year fellowship, postdoctoral fellowship, at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University before taking her current position. And so we're always happy to have a chance to speak with someone while they're here for our lecture series. I'll begin our questions, I think as I have been recently, with just asking you, Julia, if you would maybe say something about how your research, your interests match at all our sort of current theme of the rural-urban integration.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me, first of all. It's great to be here. So, yeah, I mean, for a very long time, I've been studying sort of rural or urban flows. And this is in terms of labor flows. And then later, I started looking at sort of fiscal flows as well. And mm-hmm. They're all kind of related. So, when I was an undergraduate, I actually spent some time studying a factory in South China. And at the time, a lot of people were doing research on factories. It was the huge export boom. Everybody knew that there were a lot of women streaming to work in these factories. And so this generated a huge amount of questions, right? How does this change gender relations in these villages? Does development through kind of women's work kind of look different from development at large? And I was very curious about this stuff. But when I got to graduate school around 2005, 2007, I started thinking, that was when the economy is starting to sort of shift a little bit. And you saw construction, real estate, these were the kind of big growth sectors. Manufacturing was sort of starting to decline a little by the late 2000s. So then I became interested in construction. So I've always been kind of interested in kind of different industries that draw on rural labor. And for me, this has become kind of emblematic. My current work, I have a book forthcoming with UC Press called Beneath the China Boom, which really looks at, historically all societies as they industrialize have sort of suppressed the rural countryside in order to draw out resources, whether it's labor, taxes, agricultural products from the countryside. This is kind of a necessary condition for capitalist industrial development. In China, this whole process has happened very differently from how it's happened in Western contexts, mm-hmm. for example. And I think the main difference is that because of its socialist legacy, the land rights system in the rural countryside was never sort of fully privatized the way it was in the West. In the West, everybody privatized the land. You could buy and sell land. And then this generated huge amount of unemployment in the rural countryside because people were being kicked off land as people bought and sold it. And these laborers would then stream to cities and become kind of what we know as the industrial workforce. This is how, you know, Britain's Industrial Revolution, everything happened. In China, of course, we have this very kind of anomalous but probably even more effective for growth kind of model where land is all socialized in the countryside. So you cannot buy and sell land. Only use rights are sort of given to rural people. And it's actually become like the ultimate welfare system. So everybody is allotted a small portion of land that they have birthrights to use until death. And then, you know, that land gets rotated to somebody else in the village. And because of this flexible use rights kind of system in the countryside, everybody can go work in a factory. Then when they're unemployed, they come back and they work the land. And it's actually generated an even more flexible labor force than the West ever had. And this, I think, accounts for a lot of the big China boom, why China's able to kind of achieve this huge sort of achievement of, you know, bringing so many people out of poverty, more people than any other historical period ever. The huge amount of double-digit GDP growth year on year for almost 10 years that it had from, you know, the mid-90s to the mid-2000s, or I'm sorry, to the early 2000s to the late 2000s. But my work is about kind of the breakage and the disjunctures that this model of development has created. And I think it's highly unsustainable, but not for the reasons that others think. I think it's really that this kind of flow of labor to the cities to generate kind of this made-in-China production model where all the labor is super cheap, then they can go back to the countryside, so it hides unemployment. And, you know, the farming subsidizes industrial labor, essentially. That's generated this huge fiscal problem in the countryside where a lot of counties, they're seeing an outflow of labor. They're seeing very few fiscal flows back from the cities back to the countryside. And now they're in huge amounts of debt. A lot of counties have kind of three times the amount of debt as they have revenues on their books. And what do they do now? The new regime has kind of actually turned more toward construction real estate. So a lot of counties are urbanizing their land. They're taking the land, reassigning it to state ownership rather than village collective ownership. And then they're building stuff, right? Malls, factories. But mainly they're building things, not factories. They're building things that are sort of what we would call more speculative in nature. So a lot of real estate, a lot of luxury real estate. Because the way that the funding of construction works, you know, a lot of that real estate kind of generates a lot more upfront revenues for county governments than kind of more productive in factories and that kind of thing would.
This is fascinating information because, in effect, you're telling us, you're sort of showing us a side of this economic miracle and economic boom and the development that has been less studied and less well understood, I think. So we encourage you to talk more about this. Something in what you've just told us gives a sense to me of sort of how you arrived at these topics. But I wonder if you might maybe back off and say something more specifically about how you got interested in the discipline and specifically China and specifically rural China has been a part of, that. So maybe say something to us about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was always interested in books, you know, but I didn't really know what kind of social science, humanities kind of thing I would go into. In undergrad, I was in this weird program called Social Studies at Harvard, and they did a lot of social theory and this kind of thing. And then I discovered something called ethnography. I just, you know, they assigned it in class, right? And I thought this was fascinating because it's a kind of you get a deep textured understanding of everyday life. It's like nonfiction, but it's also more than nonfiction because it was making some kind of argument, but it also gave you the same kind of understanding as you get in fiction of like character, individual level kind of details. And I thought it was fascinating. And, you know, I don't know, everyone has like books that I find most people loved the same books. When you become a professor, you realize everyone was inspired by the same kinds of books and this kind of thing. So anyway, I really love this Ain't No Making It. It's this ethnography of inner city youth in Boston. It's written by Jay McLeod. Anyway, so everybody loves this book. So I got really fascinated in it. And then at the same time, you know, I had an uncle who ran a factory. He's a Taiwanese investor, and he was running a factory in South China near Shenzhen. So that's how I got into studying factory women. It was a huge kind of trend at the time. In the 90s, everybody, in early 2000s, I did this in 2002, everybody was studying factory women. It was like a big, you know, popular sure. thing to do or something. I mean, it still kind of is. I mean, Leslie Chang's book just came out, right? I mean, not just came out, a couple of years ago, but I signed the book. I think it's lovely. I think it's like got a really nice sense of everyday life in it and stuff. So I loved that genre of writing, and that's kind of why I did my PhD in sociology because of it. I also thought there's questions you want to answer about human behavior, right? And every kind of discipline has a different answer to the question of why, what is the motivation for human behavior or certain outcomes, right? If you study economics, you think, oh yes, it's sort of like some calculation of benefit and cost or something, rational choice. Political science, a different answer. Sociology's answer was always something like, you know, there's social structures that really generate norms that that direct how we actually feel. So even your own tastes, things that you think are totally in your own control, totally individual to you. No. They're social norms that are individually kind of invisibly, governing how you feel or something. There's these spooky structures that are sort of driving all of us. And, you know, when you're like at a certain age where you really, that resonates with you a little bit because you read Marx. I think everyone goes through a Marx phase. You read Marx and you think, yes, you know, that's what is actually going on with markets. You know, these commodities are being sort of presented to us as like, you know, actual things, but you know, behind them, there's all this labor, there's all this supply chain stuff is all crystallized into this thing. So anyway, so I really got into this kind of view of the world or something. And I'm still into it, but I've kind of moved into a more sort of like, you know, some questions I think are sort of social structure governs things, but some questions, you know, you have to look to culture, you have to look to, you know, other kinds of things as well. So anyway, that was sort of my route into social science and then also into China in particular. And, you know, why China? I think everybody studies China because the scale of transformation is so vast. I remember everyone has their first time that they went to China. Mine was in 2001. 2001. Sorry. This is for a language program, Princeton, mm-hmm. Beijing. Mm-hmm. And you go there and you know, it's funny. Back then, everyone went and they would stay in the friendship hotels. Now these like aren't, this is not a thing anymore, right? Mm-hmm. Back then, I mean, you know this better than I, like, you know, access to research looked a lot different than it does today. Things are just changing at such a preposterous scale. At this, the rate of change in China is absolutely insane. And so that is a huge, I thought there was something tragic even about how quickly things, there's always twists and turns to fate in Chinese life that you kind of don't get in the US, you know, like people whose parents went through the Cultural Revolution and they were struggled against. And then suddenly, you know, the reform comes and, you know, other people are getting rich, and there is a huge reversal of fortunes. Like people at the bottom of the social strata suddenly became insanely wealthy, right? I mean, this is the kind of thing that it creates huge upheaval in families and family narratives. And it's like a given. You have to take it for granted. People take it for granted in China that there's these huge reversals and upturns in people's livelihoods. I find that fascinating as a sociologist. Does social structure kind of persist through all of these reversals? What norms change? How quickly do they change? How sticky were these norms to begin with? You know, people who study market transitions always sort of look at these sort of the stickiness of norms before and after market transitions, this kind of thing. I thought it was very fascinating.
That's quite interesting, and I think leads easily to what was going to be the last question, but I'm going to bump it up because I think it will be a good moment for you to talk a little bit about fieldwork experiences or your approaches to fieldwork. And so you've worked both in large cities, mm-hmm. But also in rural places where mm-hmm. some of these migrants come from.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you might just want to share a little about your thoughts on what it's like to do the field work, what the challenges are, what rewards are of this.
Sure. Well, yeah, so I started doing field work in these small factory towns, one in Shunde City near Shenzhen. And, you know, the feel of that is, you know, I was trained kind of, there's a whole tradition of ethnography where you're in the factory and you're doing the work alongside them. This is sort of like you work alongside the workers and you sort of use your own experience, your own body as a kind of tool of instrument of research or something. I didn't quite do piecework. I wasn't like on the assembly line with the workers, but I sat on the assembly line with the workers and talked to them as they worked. And this is a very informal factory. It wasn't kind of the kind of highly regulated Foxconn assembly line that you would think of. I found that fascinating, but there's also a way in which, I mean, that's the difficulty of the fieldwork, is it's quite depressing, actually, because this is such a sort of highly regimented workday. And I was sitting there for like 12 to 16 hours with the workers. It's a bleak kind of life or something. Then, you know, I went and in graduate school, I did ethnography of construction workers, right? So I started in the cities. I started in Beijing by sort of, I had a research partner named Qi Xin, who was at the Tsinghua Department of Sociology at the time. Her and I would kind of talk our way into these construction sites. Mainly she talked her way into these construction sites. She would bring gifts to the bosses who ran these construction sites. They're always subcontractors. The bosses are never local people. They're rural people who are subcontractors, right? And then they have this huge, like, kind of very informal but highly organized line of labor recruitment, where each subcontractor has, you know, teams of workers, and he's phoned up a foreman in some village that he's been recruiting labor out of for the last 20 years. And that guy then brings, you know, 20 village men, and they all arrive and they pitch a tent or they get a little room in this ramshackle, you know, building. If you've ever been to Beijing, you've seen these white and blue buildings, white buildings with blue kind of trimming that are temporarily, erected during periods of construction. And there is always ongoing construction in Beijing somewhere, right? That's where the workers live, right? So each room would house 20 men from Sichuan, 20 men from Anhui, 20 men from, you know, such and such village. They never talked to each other, these people. They're there to work, and then they're constantly sending money. They go to they use a postal savings bank to send money back to their families. They don't talk to other workers. In fact, you know, the labor process is very fluid, and there's always sort of unexpected changes in the production schedule. So sometimes the whole team will be unexpectedly let go if construction, you know, production slows down, or they'll bring in another team from another province. So it's highly precarious, unstructured, you know, it's highly precarious work. And so we studied this. We would sit in the dorm and talk to people. We did kind of a small-scale survey of construction workers at multiple sites while we were there. And we've really focused on this one team of workers from Sichuan province and their subcontractor, this guy named Boss Bo. And my friend Qi Xin, she kept in touch with these workers for many, many years, actually, for 10 years. And through her diligent work in keeping touching with people, I was able to track down some of the workers. I was able to track down Boss Bo, the guy that brought them there. And then, you know, one of them invited me to live in his house in the village with his wife. Of course, he wasn't there because he was working construction in cities, but his wife, and he said, my wife would love to host you. So I said, okay, great. You know, I applied for some grants. I got myself to China. And I went, and, you know, it was rocky. It was doing field work in the countryside is completely different. You feel like, first of all, I felt like it was not dangerous in the sense of like bodily danger. Nobody was going to rob me, but it was dangerous in the sense of I couldn't trust really anybody. But that's kind of And this is not to say that I couldn't trust rural people because they're untrustworthy. Everyone was incredibly trustworthy. But there's a sense, there's kind of a weird frontier sense of fieldwork in the sense that they're reading you in a very different way than you're reading them. They're reading you as a possible resource. In some way, you're some kind of alien from the outside. You get dropped there. They all know that this woman is she's a graduate student. But that doesn't mean anything to them. She's a student. She's some kind of intellectual. She's here to study us. I don't really know why, right? But, you know, she seems fairly wealthy because she's from the U.S. And we're actually all sort of interested in the U.S., right? She's Taiwanese, so we're all interested in Taiwan. So there were always these interest, points of interest through which they read kind of me. And I was interested in them for completely illegible reasons to them, right? They had no idea why I was there. And I would say, oh, you know who's fascinating is your friend over there. Could you introduce me to him? And they would think, why would she want to know my friend, you know? So in that way, you're always communicating through this very weird veil during fieldwork. And that's what feels so slippery. That's what I mean when I say you couldn't trust anybody. They couldn't trust you because they didn't know your true intentions. I couldn't trust them because I didn't know exactly what they were thinking. People were always asking me for money. And then, you know, one woman asked me for money to go to the dentist. And then the next day her neighbor came over and said, you know, she's lying. She's a liar. She doesn't need money for the dentist. Her kid goes to school and she has plenty of money for that. And her husband just gave her money last week. You know, she's lying to you. And I thought, why is this like a huge drama? But everything was a drama. Plus you're in a village. So everything is public drama. Villages are such gossip parties. I mean, the whole thing, the whole set of a village is like... The thick norms are created through gossip. So like, and then you become the center of this gossip life. So it was kind of fascinating and very intense, actually. Also, you know, at the time I didn't have a very good internet connection. You know, I had like I could get on the internet like several times a day, but only for brief periods. It wasn't a very good connection. So it did feel very, very intense. I remember telling myself, okay, I should go to the country. I have to go to the countryside because the countryside, you know, nobody was really studying. People were studying the countryside, obviously, anthropologists always have. But from this labor perspective, from the perspective of, you know, looking at how is the countryside the bedrock of urban development, which is really what I was interested in, nobody was doing this. Whenever they studied labor, they'd study either the factory towns or the cities. If they were studying development, you know, a lot of people were studying entrepreneurs in cities. A lot of people were studying sort of shadow banking in cities. Everything was happening in cities. And I thought, I really think the countryside is the bedrock of development in China. That's the secret to the Chinese kind of economic growth boom, is the way the countryside is organized. So you have to go there. And so then I told myself, well, you know, I have to do I wanted to do something very intense. You know, like I'd read these kind of classic anthropologies. And you know, people, anthropologists, they spend like years there sometimes. I thought, okay, graduate school is the only time you'll be able to replicate this kind of thing, right? Later in life, you'll never have the autonomy to do this again, or the energy, et cetera. So I did 2 years and I did it nonstop. I didn't take any breaks. And the reason I didn't take breaks is because I realized if I took a break, it would be hard for me to come back because it was actually really hard to be there. It was very intense. It was just very intense. And you know, it was a little bit depressing too. It's really hard to be in the countryside. I mean, you realize one of the reasons why these factory youth are coming to work in factories, which are onerous, horrible, bleak places, is because the countryside is actually very bleak as well. You know, there's a sense that there are no prospects. There's nothing interesting going on there. It's a place where babies and old people live, you know? That also made it, it was difficult, but it was ultimately, I think, you know, I got kind of a snapshot of rural life that you couldn't get if you didn't stay there for a very long time.
I'm very glad I asked you these questions, because I agree that there's less of this study, and I guess we would have to say less of this commitment to go through that kind of hardship that you went through. It is a sort of a classical form of anthropological or sociological ethnography that is fading as more people focus on bankers and mm-hmm. other things. Mm-hmm. But indeed, there's a lot to be seen in the countryside.
Yeah.
So I'm very glad we asked you that. And that allows me to ask really my final question, which is just...
So my book, Beneath the China Boom, Labor, Citizenship, and the Making of a Rural Land Market, it's coming out on UC Press this March or April 2020. And it's a book that's 10 years in the making. I mean, I mentioned, you know, the fieldwork for it started a long time ago. But it really asks kind of a pretty simple question, kind of at large is asking the question, what are the foundations of Chinese economic growth? But, you know, that's a huge question. The more specific question that it asks is, you know, lately there's been a turn toward urbanization as an engine of growth. So land revenues make up 77% of local government revenues now across China. Huge construction projects, the merging of existing cities to become kind of super cities, infrastructural development, real estate development, housing boom, all of this stuff has become kind of fundamental to what development looks like in China now. And so my book is really asking the question, you know, what are the causes and the consequences of this shift? And I believe there's kind of a shift from labor-intensive development, which is what we saw during the export boom, to kind of land-intensive development, where land, not labor, has now become the major sort of source of profits for local governments, and also just economic profits as well across the board. And so, you know, the question of why, what's caused this? Well, it's this fiscal crisis that was born of labor-intensive development in the past. So basically, labor-intensive development has been so kind of geographically uneven. It's really sucked resources out of the countryside in order to fuel economic growth in cities. And it's created this unsustainable kind of thing in the countryside where counties that are undergoing fiscal bankruptcy are now looking towards flipping land, using the one asset that they have, which is a lot of rural land, in order to generate land transfer fees and other sources of revenues that they can use to kind of service their own debts. And so this is actually ushered in this new form of development, which is kind of a very unstable form of urbanization where, you know, you hear about ghost cities being built, the infrastructure for cities being built without the people that are going to live in them. And this is very much a form of urbanization that's not centered around people, it's centered around fiscal deficits, right? And indeed, a lot of the people who used to live on the land that's being now used, it used to be worthless and now it's like highly, highly valued. The people who lived on it, they're being taken off the land, but they're not really admitted into cities. You know, they're not really sort of given employment. They're being told to purchase these commodity housing within townships that are built nearby in order to house them. And these townships themselves, you know, they're more concerned with servicing their debts and maximizing profits from this, you know, kind of real estate speculative form of development than they are, you know, concerned with welfare or sort of generating employment for these people. So now we have a particular form of urban development, which is kind of people-less, I would say. You know, it's more about the infrastructure than it is about the people. So that's really what my book is about.
I look forward to seeing it soon.
Thanks. Great. Yeah.
And thanks so much for taking time to talk to us, and looking forward to your talk
Great.
This evening as well.
Great. Thank you so much.
The East Asia Program would like to thank the Language Resource Center and Sam Lupowitz for his help in recording this podcast.